Welcome to On the Couch, a podcast from Reaction with me, Lucy Beresford, broadcaster and psychotherapist, taking a deep dive into the relationships making the headlines in politics today and exploring the psychology and personalities in global political life. It is freezing in the UK right now, but elsewhere, could relations between the nations be thawing? To help me shine a light, or maybe that should be a blowtorch, onto 2023 and the UK and its place in the world, I am thrilled to be joined by Lord Darick of Kew. Lord Darick is the former British ambassador to the US. He originally hails from Consett and, like me, is an alumni of Durham University, so he knows all about trying to function in sub-zero temperatures. Hello, Kim.
Hello, Lucy.
Lovely to have you here on my couch, as they say. You, in your life as a diplomat, I see you as someone who's probably had to take the temperature of the UK's relations with many other countries. And I would love to know, to start with, where on that barometer do you think we're at as we arrive in 2023? Where are the UK's relations with the key players in the world, with the States, with China, with Europe?
I think they're in a slightly better place, Lucy, than they were 6 months or 12 months ago. So January 2023 feels a little bit better than January 22. But that's not a high bar to cross, because with both, the main allies we have are in Europe and the United States, obviously Australia and New Zealand as well, but that's where you look to first. And under Boris Johnson, and then again under Liz Truss, relations with Europe were strained. We all remember Liz Truss, when asked whether France was friend or foe, said the jury's still out, or words to that effect. And Boris Johnson was often taking pot shots at European allies over their failure to give him exactly what he wanted on Brexit. And although it's not necessarily changed in substance, we can talk about where we are on the Northern Ireland Protocol, that stuff, certainly the mood music has changed with Rishi Sunak in number 10, both with United States and with Europe. And there's positive noises coming out about the negotiations with the European Union on Northern Ireland, which are being watched very, very closely in Washington. So we feel a little less isolated than we did at the start of last year. That said, we're still obviously in a difficult place with Russia, thanks to Putin's appalling invasion of Ukraine. And that's not going to change whoever is in number 10. You know, it wouldn't matter, I think, which government was in power in the UK. We would be where we are on Ukraine. And they're not good with China either. If I remember correctly, when Rishi Sunak was at an international meeting recently, he had a meeting scheduled with President Xi, which was cancelled at short notice. That golden era under Cameron and Osborne seemed to last about 6 months. I tell you, it's well over now. So it's a lot of tension in relations with China. And obviously, Russia's invasion of Ukraine and our support for Ukraine dominates that relationship. But in terms of things about our eyes, they're just a little bit better.
And we breathe a sigh of relief for that. But obviously, events can turn on a sixpence. And there's very much a sense of making sure that relationships are maintained in order to make sure that they can weather any storms that pop up. And I'm very struck by the fact that we've got this big global opportunity this week with the Great and the Good meeting in Davos, or rather the great and the good of the business world, which, to be fair, it often was always like that. But there seem to be fewer world leaders there this year, and many leaders and many commentators have said that it's partly to do with the cost of living crisis, that it wouldn't be very good optics to go off to a Swiss ski resort to hobnob with lots of business leaders. But I'm wondering whether you think that's a missed opportunity.
There's a fair number of annual events now, G20 summits, G8 summits, and so on, where international leaders, especially Western leaders, can meet. But none of them are coming around quickly. Remember, both the Blair number 10, which I worked in, Cameron number 10, which I worked in, they were fairly assiduous attenders of Davos. Actually, for a Labour Prime Minister, that was quite a shift, because Blair was very comfortable going off and, as you say, hobnobbing with world business leaders, whatever some of the people in the Labour Party thought about this. So it is a bit of a missed opportunity, but if you look at the backdrop, you can sort of understand it, because every Western government is struggling with cost of energy and with cost of food. Every Western government is under pressure from public opinion over not resolving those issues. But so far, touch wood, we have agreed about the strategic objective of ensuring that Putin does not succeed with his invasion of Ukraine. And that is costing the West a lot. It's costing in terms of the costs of looking after a few million Ukrainian refugees. It's costing in terms of food and energy prices. And it's costing, of course, in terms of all the military equipment we are supplying. And don't underestimate that, Lucy. I mean, you know, the store cupboards in a lot of Western governments for military equipment are almost bare. So much has gone to Ukraine. I mean, just one example, the Ukrainians have been using 5,000 to 7,000 artillery shells a day at the height of the conflict in recent months. The Russians were up to about 20,000 artillery shells a day. That is more, add that through the month, and it's more than, for example, the American armaments industry generally is producing. So when supplies, stocks have been hugely depleted, they will be replenished during the winter, when I expect fighting to subside quite a lot. But if there are, as I expect, offensives starting next spring, one of the questions will be whether the West can actually supply what Ukraine needs. It probably means actually some of the factories that make this stuff go on to double shifts or whatever. So put all of that together, and there's plenty of problems that will keep governments, prime ministers, and finance ministers sitting at home worrying day to day about how they resolve these problems, rather than going off to Davos and listening to the giants of the tech world, the giants of the business and finance world, telling them what they should be doing. So I can sort of understand it.
That's the irony then, isn't it? Because actually, Zelensky is due to speak there. I think it's this afternoon, just after we record this. So he is there, hoping to drum up more support and probably more, as you say, more importantly, tanks and ammunition. But while the cost of living crisis remains the only game in town for other leaders, they are staying away. So Zelensky isn't necessarily speaking to the audience that he wants, unless he imagines that the business world will pile pressure on the political world. What actually could Davos achieve geopolitically, do you think, this week?
It's a good point, and I don't think the business world will see it as their role to put pressure on Western governments over armaments for Ukraine. Although it is, I think, a sort of moral issue for all of us not to allow Putin to succeed with this unprovoked oppression, which has ruined millions of lives and killed hundreds of thousands. I mean, Let's just try and forget just what a horrendous toll there has been from this war. But what Zelensky will have in Davos is he'll have the eyes of the world media on him. So in that sense, it's still a very good platform to get his message across through the media to governments and to populations around the world. The big question which you identified just now is, if Ukraine is to have a chance of actually achieving its objective of winning in the course of 2023, of driving Russians off its soil, it's not enough just to have artillery shells and the other sort of kit that we've been supplying them so far. They need tanks, they need armored personnel carriers, they need high-tech missiles, they need more artillery, they need some really expensive stuff. And I think the question for the West, I mean, Russia's got three objectives, I think, this year. One, they want to hold on to what they've got in Ukraine. And if they can grab a bit more in the East, do that. Second, they want to break the will of the Ukrainian people through these missile and artillery attacks on population centers and on Ukrainian infrastructure. And third, and this is where we come in, they want to break the will of the West. They want us to conclude that the costs of looking after the refugees and arming Ukraine and coping with these energy and food costs, those costs become too much for us, and we go to the Ukrainians and say, we can't do this any longer, and you need to do a deal, any deal, with Russia to stop this war. And you know, are we up to actually maintaining Western solidarity and giving what the Ukrainians what they need for what we agree is the objective, which is the defeat of Russia, the expulsion of Russian forces from Ukrainian soil? Do we have the will for that? And that's the crucial strategic question for the West, I think, for the 2023.
Whether they can band together and whether Zelensky...
Whether they can stick together and actually take the domestic pain and costs of this and maybe increase our own production of the weapons and ammunition that Ukraine needs so that we can actually achieve what we all say is the objective, which is victory over Russia.
And a moral victory as well as a...
Yeah, absolutely. Because, I mean, just think, you see, of the message it sends to autocrats, to tyrants around the world, if Putin were actually to achieve anything that looked like a success in Ukraine. Think what sort of message it would send to China with its ambitions for Taiwan. You know, it's not just about Ukrainian soil, this. It's a much bigger strategic question.
And actually, talking of autocratic nations, I'd like to ask you about Iran as well this week. A diplomatic nightmare, maybe you would call it, a diplomatic nightmare of a story broke this week, which pulled together Prince Harry's memoir, Spare, and Iran, who used some information that he had put in that memoir, namely his Taliban kill count revelation. Iran used that to justify its execution of Alireza Akbari, who had been accused of spying for MI6. He was the former Iranian deputy defense minister. And now his execution is a major escalation, I would suggest, in those tensions between the West and Iran. And they were already running pretty high because of the they've been brutally cracking down on their anti-regime protesters, which the West has been very vocal about. Tehran has, I think, offered military drone support for Russia. I mean, where do you see that story going in 2023?
I think 2023, I mean, I think that the best that can happen, I mean, obviously things can escalate. You know, stuff can happen, as has happened in the past in the Gulf. It's very, very volatile. But the likeliest thing is we will continue to have this standoff with Iran through 2023. We will continue to keep comprehensive sanctions in place. There will continue to be efforts to try to resume the deal that we had until President Trump pulled the plug on it, on the Iranian nuclear program.
You think we'll still want to engage with them on that, do you, despite this latest...
I'm not sure you're going to see big public conferences about it. You know, I think it will be done mostly behind the scenes.
Right.
But I think channels will be kept open to Iran to see if we can restore that that deal, updated as it would need to be, given that Iran has restarted some of the things that the deal banned. Mm-hmm. But above that, relations will stay. This is an appalling regime. It's deeply repressive towards its people. It's brutal. And it's paranoid. It still thinks of us, let's remember, as the little Satan and America as the big Satan. That mindset hasn't changed. So they're always looking for conspiracies out there. They always believe that we are out to do them down one way or another. They believe that we actually want regime change in Iran. And it's very difficult to overcome these decades of hostility and suspicion. Though, as you know, Lucy, there is a sophisticated middle class in Tehran, in Iran, which is really suffering under this appalling leadership. This is a country with huge potential, great people capital. I mean, they're very talented people, the Iranians, but suffering under this terrible government. So I think it'll be more of the same. Keep our fingers crossed that you don't get anything that makes things worse. Expect under the private contacts to go on about nuclear issues and about whether there are ways in which the Iranians will just back off some of the destructive things they're doing around the region. But there's going to be no rapprochement and no sort of great breakthrough, I think, in 2023. You do notice and keep watching. There have been protests. There was some quite strong and quite widespread protests against the Iranian regime by Iranian people in 2022. And those can be sparked off again if they're not going on already. It's hard to know quite what's going on. So there is a lot of pent-up frustration with Iran's leadership amongst the Iranian people, which is worth watching.
Yes, we saw a little bit of that on show, not least in the World Cup, where there were protests made by the Iranian footballers themselves, which echoed protests that were happening at home. So I think it's becoming more widespread. Final couple of questions for you. Talking about breakthrough moments, if you were in a room with Rishi Sunak and he turned to you and said, Kim, if there was one country that I could go to or should go to tomorrow, which could make a lot of difference just by me being there with the leader or me meeting with the right people, where would you send him?
Oh, that is a good question. A tricky question. Look, once upon a time, before the Ukrainian war, we diplomats will always have said you need to keep channels open to Russia and to Putin, because he lives in a world where he's never told the truth by the people who work for him. So he receives this completely paranoid, distorted view of what's going on in the West, what people think about Russia and all the rest of it. But sadly, after the invasion of Ukraine, you can't do that anymore. He simply put himself beyond all limits, and I can't see any Western leader really engaging with Putin, trying to explain the reality of life to him. I think it would be good if, current circumstances, I would probably send him off to talk to Zelensky, to have a really serious discussion about Ukrainian objectives and war aims. Because I'll tell you what I think is going to happen in 2023, Lucy. As the war looks like it's going to drag on and on, there's going to be no resolution in 2023, which I think is the likeliest outcome here. You will find more and more voices, especially in European capitals, but not just in Europe. There are voices in the American Congress that are saying this, who will say, we just can't afford this indefinitely. I mean, this can go on for years and years and years. And at some point, this guy has to do a deal to end the war. And actually, the sooner the better. And I'm not sure that the West will be prepared indefinitely to sign up to supporting and paying for the war, because all of the stuff we're supplying, they could not prosecute the war without everything that we are doing to help them. I mean, is the West going to say to Zelensky, we'll support you to the last centimetre of Ukrainian soil, we'll support you to expel Russians out of Crimea, from the last centimetre of the Donbass and so on. That is Zelensky's objective. And I think the British government would support him. I'm not confident that all European governments would. I'm not confident that it could be supported indefinitely. So I think there needs to be a serious conversation with Zelensky at some point or other about what victory for Ukraine and defeat for Putin actually means on the ground, and whether they really think that they're going to recapture Crimea in particular. Mm-hmm. Crimea is the biggest issue. And the second thing I would say is, at some point, he needs to talk to President Xi of China, because China is doing a lot of bad things around the world. It's bullying its neighbors, intimidating its neighbors. It is breaking international law by some of the things it's doing in the South China Sea. It is threatening Taiwan. It's behaving in not as a responsible member of the international community, but as a country which is prepared to use force and intimidation to achieve its objectives. On the other hand, see, we can't achieve what we need to do on the existential challenge of this century, which is climate change, without working with China. So we have to find a way of achieving a more constructive relationship with China. And, it'll be really difficult, and they will not like us lecturing them about their human rights record, what they're doing in Hong Kong, telling them that the use of force against Taiwan is absolutely out of the question, and they've got to do something on climate change and the rest of it. They won't like those messages, but you have to have channels for getting through to them. And people overestimate, I think, quite how solid Xi's position is. China has just lost 60,000, I mean, they had 60,000 deaths, I think, from COVID in the last month or so. So COVID is raging there in a way that it hasn't done hitherto, if Chinese figures for their COVID casualties have been accurate in the past. I don't know if they have, but anyway, they have real domestic challenges in China, and in theory, they should want a calmer international picture in which they could address these challenges. So I don't think it's inconceivable that that we can find a way of working with China if we really put some effort in. And by the way, China is more vulnerable from the impact from climate change than many, many other countries. So they've got to do something about that. So I think it's worth, it's important to talk to them, however difficult that will be.
To keep those channels open. Well, my final question to you is more broad, really. I was very intrigued to see there's a global leader approval tracker that comes out every week, and Narendra Modi sits very firmly on the top of it, which I find quite interesting. Joe Biden, I think, is fourth. Rishi Sunak, sort of about eighth or ninth. As a diplomat, you have been up close to so many leaders. I was just wondering, what qualities do you think a leader needs to have, and therefore what are the implications both for Rishi Sunak but also for Sir Keir Starmer?
Well, yes.
Do either of them have what it takes is what I'm really asking you.
I think 2022 was extraordinary in the UK, three prime ministers. And I think Rishi Sunak has done and will do the best job of any of those three. I think he has an extraordinarily difficult time ahead of him, though, because of the economy, because of international challenges, and because of the legacy he's inherited. Because people will not quickly forgive the Conservatives for crashing the economy in the way they did. I mean, anyone who has a mortgage, and a lot of people do, is going to be hit by the impact of those 45 days of Liz Truss and that mini budget. So I think he has a really tough time here. Look, what does a leader need to be successful? I mean, it's quite a lot of things, and you know, it's hard to find people who fulfill all. He needs clarity of vision and clear objectives. He or she mustn't just bounce around from day to day, you know, coping with that day's crisis or that day's 24-hour news cycle or whatever, and just responding to that. He or she needs to know what they're trying to achieve, how they're going to get there, and keep returning to those messages. Second, you need presentational skills. You need to be able to get across to the public just what it is you're trying to achieve. And in that day-to-day sort of chaos of politics, keep an eye on your objectives and keep reminding people how what you're doing day-to-day fits into those big strategic objectives. You need luck. And that's where I worry a bit for Sunak, because I think he's inherited the prime ministership at an extraordinarily unlucky time, a really difficult time. You need friends and allies around the place. He's doing better on that than either Truss or Johnson. But it's going to be tough. It really is going to be tough. And what I thought in the autumn of last year was that Keir Starmer was starting to look like a credible figure as Prime Minister. I think he had a very successful Labour Party conference. And he's just looking much, much more credible, as is his front bench. So to add to the disasters that the Conservatives had in 2022, you have Labour looking a lot more credible on that. And that's all makes a very difficult picture. When I look at the most successful prime ministers that I worked for, and that's Margaret Thatcher and Tony Blair, it was that clarity of vision and the ability to articulate it that you remember most, plus the way they were able to get the government appearing to be able to focus on them and sort of deliver things step by step that were matching those objectives. And I haven't seen that in the last few years from a British government. So that's what you need if you're going to win the next election. And it's not impossible, by the way, however good Starmer is looking and however tough things look for Sunak, you know. People's memories are short, and if things look much better by 2024, people might forget what happened in 2022. Wouldn't want to bet on it, but it's possible.
On that note, Lord Darrick, Kim Darrick, thank you very much indeed for being on my couch.
Thank you.